Let's welcome Greg Norfeld.
Thank you. Welcome. Hi, I'm Greg Norfeld. I've had three traumatic brain injuries. Traumatic brain injuries are called TBIs. I am a blended family man. I have six kids and 15 grandchildren. Have you ever had a change in your identity? I've had a few. Hi, I'm Greg Norfeld. I was a 35-year senior management banker. I worked hard so I could play harder. I was an adrenaline junkie. I jumped off things. I dove into things. And I rode things. My last TBI landed me in a coma where I had a near-death experience. I ate a bad trout on a Harley ride near Coeur d'Alene, Idaho in 2011, and I got food poisoning. I was the road boss. And my wife, Lara, she was on her tricked-out lowrider. And she was hot, like she is now. And our friend Jimmy was behind us. She watched me pass out on my bike. My head drooped to the right, and I rode into a ditch full of lava rocks. The crash was violent, and it was horrendous and gruesome. When it was all over, I was crushed by the largest Harley made, an Ultra. Jimmy and Lara ran up to me, and they were horrified. My leg was sticking out from under my bike at an angle you'd never want to see a leg pointing at. But I was in a coma immediately, and it was my new safe place. Last summer, we went back to visit Coeur d'Alene, and we went to Kootenai Health, the hospital that saved my life. And I got to visit with the surgeons and the critical care team and the CEO and say thank you for all that they did for me and my family. And they said, Greg, it's so good to see you upright. Then when we saw each other, we hugged and we cried. It was a tender moment because I wasn't conscious 5 years ago when it happened. We were there on our 5-year anniversary. So it was good to see those people for the first time. When we got back home, they asked us to be their spokespeople for their upcoming Festival of Trees fundraising Black Tie Gala event. And their CEO, he asked us to help them beat their record of donations because they were building out their ER and their OR. They just happened to be the two areas of the hospital that helped save my life and rebuild my body that was broken. Of course, we said yes. It's okay. They filmed a video of us and they used the video to help promote their fundraising gala. And then it was later edited for my speaking business. We love having adventures together. It's part of us. It's who we are. If somebody was to say, who are Greg and Lara, they would say they're traveling adventure people. And things have changed a bit. It was August of 2011, and we decided with one of our friends, Jimmy, to take a ride from Salt Lake City to Coeur d'Alene. Our third night on this ride, we had just finished the Lolo Pass, incredible motorcycle ride, and I unfortunately chose to eat trout that night. Unfortunately, it had spoiled, and I ate it anyway because I was starving. I don't have much memory of the next morning, to be honest.
He just kept getting sicker as the morning went on and didn't feel good, but he kept riding thinking he'd be okay. He put his blinker on, and the next thing, it was about down to 30 miles an hour, starting to pull over, and the next thing I saw, his head just tipped. He passed out and went off the side of the road, and he went down into the lava rock and flipped over, did a complete 180 and flipped over in the gully. So I ran down into the gully, and Jimmy came right behind me, and Greg's bike was on top of him, so we had to push it off of him. And I was just trying to assess what kind of condition he was in. His right leg was kind of turned off to one side. I could tell that he had a compound fracture in his leg. But mostly I was just concerned that he was still breathing. We actually got down into the ED, and I said, "Where am I? Where are we?" And they said, "Coeur d'Alene." I said, "Well, I can't stay here. We're not staying here. I need to take him home to Salt Lake. We're not going to treat him here." And Dr. Bowen pulled me into the next room that was empty, and he said, if something happened to someone in my family, he said, "I want Dr. Danzel taking care of them." He said, "You trust me on this one, Laurie. You got to trust him.
In addition to my brain injury, I had a lot of broken bones in the right side of my body. My femur was broke, knee was shattered, dislocated. Dr. Bowen is an orthopedic surgeon, amazing technical skills. I was at Kootenai Health for 11 days, many days in ICU in a coma.
And I'm scared to death. I'm scared to death of what's going to happen and how my new life is going to change. And these people at the hospital are treating me so good. Like they're so good to me, and they're always keeping me up to date and telling me what's going on and letting me know what's happening.
People took Laura and I in their family, in their arms. We were held by them and carried by them through days and days of critical condition hospital care.
You can have all the technology, all the gadgets in a hospital. You can have all the stuff you want. It's the people. And that's what meant everything to me.
One of the nurses in the ICU had to take me in for a CT scan. They put me on the bed, and I was all over the place. I couldn't hold still. She held my hand, whispered in my ear, calm me down to the point that they could take this CT scan with my head holding still, and so Dr. Gans could make a good diagnosis on me and continue the treatment of me. So that's just one example of the amazing care that we received while we were at Kootenai. The amazing thing about my luck of crashing near Coeur d'Alene and being flown to Kootenai Health is that the physicians are highly skilled, and the technical savvy of the critical care team is at the highest level. Dr. Gans, Dr. Bowen, surgical teams, ICU team, emergency room team, the neuro rehab team. I was very lucky that I crashed near this site and was flown to this hospital.
What's even more remarkable, though, is what they've done with their experience. They have taken what was a personal tragedy full of adversity, full of question marks and hard work for him to get back to where he was fully functional again, and then have turned that into a mission for them, for him to advocate for head-injured patients in the Salt Lake City area, and for her, advocacy for the families of people with head injuries.
When I speak in public, I speak about Kootenai Health. It's a part of who I am, and I hope they understand and recognize it, and that feels good to them.
They paid it forward, paid the good care that they got here forward, and that's the best thanks I could ask for.
Yes, we helped them break the record of donations. We raised over $500,000 that night. But the question remained, who is Greg Nordfeldt? Because the old Greg is gone. By the time it took Laura to stop her Harley, put her kickstand down, and get safely off her bike, my identity and my personality changed for the rest of my life. Hi. I'm Greg Nordfeldt. What defines me are the meaningful, heartfelt, human relationships that I make in my life. Much of my left brain doesn't work, but I have access to my right brain that's creative. Wow, what a difference from being a lifetime analytical banker. I'm a motivational speaker. I'm a writer. This is my upcoming memoir, Ride On, Adventures in Traumatic Brain Injury. I am a mentor at Intermountain Medical Center's Neuro Rehab. I help TBI survivors overcome obstacles and hurdles that I overcame 6 years ago and am still working on today with the help of neuroplasticity. Our brain's ability over our lifetime to heal, if we choose to use the tools that our neuro rehab physicians and therapists give us. 6 years ago, when I crashed, my huge forehead, I don't know if you've noticed how big it is, it's huge. Right above my helmet visor on the right side, it had a huge collision with the sharp tip of a lava rock. And that set my brain in motion. And my gray matter had an even more vicious collision with the opposite side of my skull. And this is where, I can hardly say this, but this is where the most traumatic part of my traumatic brain injury occurred. I was immediately unconscious. My Glasgow coma rating was a 6. A 3 is brain dead. My body and my brain were broken. You heard earlier that my knee was shattered. My femur was broke. My big toe was smashed under my steel-toed Harley boots. And I had lacerations throughout the right side of my body. But all that was minor compared to the injuries inside of my brain. Meanwhile, I was at peace. Laura and Jimmy, they were using all of their adrenaline to lift over 1,000 pounds of Harley off of me in a bed of lava rocks. I was in my euphoric happy place. Laura immediately knew I was in critical condition. She wrapped me in a blanket to protect me from shock. She cradled my head in her lap after she sat on the lava rocks and gently tipped me so I didn't aspirate my vomit. She saved my life and kept me alive for 45 minutes until Lifelight finally found us. Then the paramedics took over. I was enveloped in a sea of love. Paramedics indicated that I had severe respiratory failure. They worked feverishly for 30 minutes. They turned off their helicopter to stabilize me. They set an IV. They gave me paralysis meds and intubated me. And then they gave me a torrid of other meds. Laura was approved to fly, and we were off. As luck would have it, the ventilator failed almost immediately, and they had to bag me by hand to keep oxygen flowing into my lungs. And the paramedic was working so hard to keep me alive and to chart and to communicate with the critical care team in the ER at the hospital. Laura offered to bag me herself, and she focused on squeezing that rubber tube by hand every 4 seconds so I wouldn't be brain dead by the time we landed on the roof of the hospital. She only glanced out the window a couple of times. The pilot called a code red to the hospital. But where was I? I was connected directly to Laura and her love, internally. Laura was in shock and severe PTSD from watching my accident and saving my life. Laura reached her breaking point in the ER when they told her that I wouldn't make a flight anywhere. I was in my happy place. My wife and lover and my best friend was being grilled about my medical history and my meds. She was making life decisions on my behalf. She had the burden of all of this ungodly situation. Laura saw everything. She felt everything. She knew everything. I don't remember anything. It's as if Laura entered that lava rock field with me
and took on all the horror herself. I was in an adjacent, euphoric field of tenderness and affection without any anxiety or any fear. Therein lies the dichotomy that Laura and I experienced 6 years ago, and I will never be able to reconcile it. The first 24 hours of a traumatic brain injury patient care is the most critical. Since this was my third TBI, serious pressure was on Dr. Gans and the neuro ICU team. My life and the ability to get the highest level of my brain functioning back was on their shoulders. It all depended on neurological exams and CT exams. They were monitoring the swelling and the bleeding in my brain, and a subdural hematoma was developing. And it was big. It was forcing my brain, as you can see in this picture, to the right, and that's called a midline brain shift. And that became the most serious issue on Dr. Gann's mind. The degree of that shift put me in brain surgery mode, and it was his decision. All the pressure was on him. But what they didn't know is Laura's mom died a few years ago from a glioblastoma, which is the worst kind of brain tumor, and it was in the center of her brain. And ironically, she was a neuro ICU RN, and she knew the risk of the biopsy that a neurosurgeon wanted to perform on her, and that she might not make it out of surgery. But her family wanted her to try anyway, and she died 2 weeks later. And that memory was on Laura's mind, and it was vivid as Dr. Gans was explaining the brain surgery options on me. And she didn't want him to cut into my skull at any cost. She wanted him to use meds to control the bleeding and swelling in my brain. She thought, if we can just get Greg home without cutting into his skull, everything will be okay. But everything was not okay. My bleeding and my swelling was massive. My near-death experience. In my new home, nothing was severe. I knew that my body was in a medical situation. I knew that there were people that were rushing around me, but I didn't know why. I didn't question why. I didn't see the need to wonder why. Why would I? The English language doesn't have enough words in it to describe the experience that I have. I know that you all have heard others say this many times. This is the best way that I know how to describe the gifts that I was given. I was deeply connected to Laura immediately after my accident, internally. You can throw out all the human senses, hearing, sight, feeling, taste, etc. They absolutely didn't come into play in the realm I was in. Where I was, I saw and knew Laura like I never had before. All of her. I was her. Her thoughts and feelings, her hope and courage, everything that was positive from her was instantly in me when she was with me. I didn't hear her words, but I felt the intensity of her drive and her motivation for me. I heard her without her talking. Her sentences came directly to me without her words. I saw her without seeing her with my eyes. All of her. I experienced her intimacy for me. There is no way for me to explain this experience to you without you experiencing it yourself. If I could internally connect with each of you through my safe place and share this experience with you, you would receive it in a millisecond and you would understand everything that I experienced, my feelings, everything that I learned and saw and felt. My hope and love without me saying one word to you. But the most important thing I can say to you tonight is Laura saved me in two distinct ways. First, physically, on that lava field. And second, internally, through her courage, through her love, and through her hope right here. That was the most important to me because I felt it directly. I had absolutely no negative feelings inside of me. I was blocked from negativity. I didn't feel any of Laura's sadness or any of her sorrow. I didn't feel anything negative at all. My safe place didn't allow adversity. It was the epitome of peace. Its core was warmth and love. It was full of positive energy. My sister Debbie came to visit me in my room. Her presence was energy. I was instantly, internally connected with her, and I knew her. I saw her in the way that we see our loved ones in our dreams, with their being and all of their feelings and thoughts and hope, but none of their uncertainty. Debbie told me later that she whispered in my ear, "Greg, please don't leave me. I can't take losing you." Before my accident, we lost my parents, my sister, and my brother, and Debbie lost her best friend in a 4-year period. She couldn't take losing me, too. My daughter Tristan and son Josh came to visit me in the hospital, and they immediately joined my force of energy. And it was like a lightning bolt hitting my safe place. I knew, and I saw them immediately. By this time, I was told I was going in and out of consciousness, but I don't remember any of that physically, but I remember all of it in my safe place as if it happened yesterday. It is so vivid to me. When they transferred me to IMC in Salt Lake City, I had my first memory in room 1219, and I had those same direct connections with our family members. Internally, when our children visited, Jody and Jeremy and Ryan and JC, I had those direct connections happen all over again, and they entered my field of energy, and the connections were strong. I continued to have those connections after my memory was given back to me in a physical way. In fact, for a year and a half, I wore rose-colored glasses. I was connected to my safe place. And then one day, reality hit me square in the face, and the last strands of my connection were gone. If anybody finds my rose-colored glasses, I want them back. I had no reference of time when I was in my coma. I'm explaining this experience to you over a sequence of time so you can have a better understanding of this event. But that's not how I remember it. When I had connections with my family members, it was circular, or in and out, or all together. It wasn't sequential. When I was in my coma, time had absolutely no meaning. There wasn't a Big Ben. My sea of love was endless. It was like I was in an ocean, and I was a tiny speck in the middle of it. It was calm, and soothing, and warm. It was the opposite of stress. If you've ever wondered and felt what you would like the world to be like and how you wanted to be treated in it, this would be the fulfillment. It was the ultimate state of bliss. I use the word blissful when talking about my coma and near-death experience. And over the last few years when I haven't wanted to talk about it, blissful as a way not to talk about it. I had no pain. Laura took this shot of me in Mexico when my toe got infected, and she thinks it's funny. I haven't had a shot in my butt since I was a kid. For the first 2 days, I laid in the hospital bed with open wounds, and I was in a coma. But Laura knew I was in pain because I was yelling and screaming every time they moved my leg and my head. And I was saying incoherent words, and they knew I was in extreme pain because Dr. Gans had to keep my pain medicines at the lowest level so he could keep track of my neurological improvement. It was really hard on her to see me suffer. When I woke up and I was getting better, the nurses were asking me what my pain level, or they were just coming in and out, and there were janitors and people delivering food, and I could speak better. I said, "Can anybody just get me some Advil so I can freaking go home?" Because that was my headache medicine of choice before my accident. But that would be the worst thing that you could give somebody if they were swelling and bleeding in their head. In my special new home, I had absolutely no pain. When I was released and I went back outpatient into neural rehab and I was relearning how to speak, read, and write, and walk again as if I was a young boy, I don't remember having pain. They gave me a bottle of Oxycontin, and that bottle was in my medicine cabinet for years. I never used it. The nurses would come in when I was in the hospital and they'd ask me my pain level, and I'd say, "It's a 7.9. And then when they'd leave, my kids would say, "Dad, what's your pain level really? And I would say 2.2. I was trying to use banker numbers or something. I never had pain from this horrific accident that I just explained to you. It's a mystery to me. Hate left me. As I told you before, I lost my parents, my sister, and my brother in a 4-year period before my accident. It damaged me. It hurt me. Hate embedded me. I hated God for taking my loved ones away from me. I got sideways with religion. So I tried having a vision of my dad. I wanted to ask him, why are all these deaths happening? And why does my religion have such a strange history? So I drank a lot of absinthe, which was rumored to have a hallucinogenic side effect. Long story short, vision didn't happen, but I got sicker than hell. And I paid for that, along with a bunch of other stuff that Rick gave me. And I'll never do that again. But I did wake up from my coma with blissfulness and love and peace. I couldn't stop hugging my family and friends and those who are around me. I started writing warmth and love in my emails, even my work emails, and texts, and social media posts, and letters. If you don't believe me, just ask my family and friends. They're tired of it. My safe place. I never thought of leaving my safe place. I had no worries, no anxiety, and I am an anxious man. I had no worries. It was beyond beautiful. A place you would never want to be disconnected from, ever. Who would ever want to leave my blissful, euphoric sea of love? I miss it dearly. Sometimes I feel like I could just reach out and touch it. Sometimes I really need it, but that's just not reality, is it? I think I would have grown tired of it. I need the adrenaline rush, the risk-reward, the fear factor, taking on a new career path, the choice of helping others, to learn from tipping over the tower of mugs on our kitchen island and breaking all of them and catching hell from Lara. But she was really nice. It's those learning moments that make or break this life. And I want them to make me. My message to you. In this life, our differences are everything that is good. We put so much emphasis on what we believe in and our religious affiliations, what nation we belong to, what groups we're in, what clubs we're a part of, what our social status is, our wealth or lack thereof, what our political views are, the color of our skin, our gender, our sexual orientation. Well, guess what? At the end of the day, all of that is noise. Many people ask me, Greg, what did you learn in your coma and your near-death experience? Well, I rarely tell anybody, but here it is. Our humanity is everything. How we treat each other, despite our differences, is everything. Each of us has to decide during this lifetime if we're going to go out of our way to make a meaningful impact on other human beings. If we choose to make internal connections a priority in this lifetime, our next adventure will take care of itself. Time for questions and answers.
Quick question.
Yes.
Do you and Mara still ride?
My bike was totaled, and I received a gracious insurance payment. And Laura sold her bike when we got home, Salt Lake, and we no longer ride. It was my third traumatic brain injury, and the surgeons begged me to hang up my spurs. Yes.
I just wondered how long you were in a coma for. I was in a coma for 10 days, and it felt like I just went to sleep and woke up the next day. It didn't seem like it was any time at all. You don't realize the time, but I wondered how long you actually were in a coma for.
I was in and out of a coma for 11 days. I think the actual time I was in a coma was 5 days, and then I was in and out for a few more days in the hospital. But then, as I said, I was in and out for, I don't have a memory for a month. That's not a direct answer to that question. Yes?
Did you actually have the brain surgery?
No, and I'm glad that I didn't, thanks to Laura.
You said that you basically became Laura. You knew how she felt. You knew her hope, her everything about it. But you said you did not feel her anxiety or her fears.
I didn't feel anything that was negative from her.
But yet she went through the worries.
She did. It was extreme. Her worries were so extreme that she had PTSD. I was blocked from anything that was negative.
Do you know why?
I have absolutely no idea why. I honestly don't know why.
Thank you.
As a result of the experience, how has your relationship with people you meet changed? Say the mailman, the clerk in the store, people you meet, how do you relate to them now compared to the past?
I am a different human being now. I wasn't lying when I said the old Greg is gone. I have a different personality. I look at people differently now. I don't know, I was a much more driven man before my accident. My career was everything. Material things meant a lot more to me than they do now. And human interaction wasn't as important to me as it is now.
Greg, why don't you tell them what you did before the accident?
I was a banker, as I said. I was at the senior management level of a local bank, and I had been offered CEO positions, several CEO positions at banks that I had turned down so I could stay at the bank that I was in. I was on the fast track to achieving higher positions at the bank, and so I decided to stay. And I guess I was from the old school of staying in the same organization for a long period of time. It worked out for me for a long time, and when I had my accident, they held my job for me, and I got it back. And I was actually, I didn't say this during my remarks, I was actually more successful in the position I was in with my new personality leading my team than I was before, because I understood my teammates better with my right brain than I did before. And I worked my butt off to learn my analytical functioning that my left brain used to do. It took me a while, but I learned how to do all the analytical stuff that I used to do with my left side, and I learned it from the right side of my brain. And I knew how to connect with people better at the same time, so I was a better team manager. Yes?
I was just thinking along those lines. I was wondering if you think if it's because you're acting out of your right brain now rather than your left. And I was wondering also if you've ever read the book, Oh, My Stroke of Insight,
oh, yeah,
by Jill Pulte Taylor. Like, if you relate to that.
Yes, I love that book, by the way. It's one of my favorite books. The fact that she was a neurologist and was conscious as she lost her left brain, that was unbelievable to read that. And I read it within the first year after my accident, and it gave me insight to everything that I experienced.
So you think your new personality is because you're operating out of the left side now rather than the right side rather than the left?
Absolutely. Yeah, absolutely.
Why don't you tell them what kind of volunteer work you do now, too?
Now, as I mentioned before, I now volunteer at Intermountain Medical Center in the neuro rehab team, and I volunteer at the outpatient group with the aphasia group twice a week, and I also am a mentor in the acute neuro rehab team and help patients that are on the same floor that I was in, helping patients and caregivers that are recovering from traumatic brain injury and stroke and spinal cord injuries. Yes.
You said you didn't feel anything. Did you say sadness? You didn't feel sadness?
No, I didn't feel Laura's.
You were happy, though.
I was blissful, but I didn't feel Laura's sadness, her sorrow. I was in complete euphoria. If you would have seen me when I woke up, I was in a, I don't know how you would describe, I was a little boy. I was like a young boy, right. And I was blissful.
And one can be really happy for a long time, but with the five senses and it being dulled for a moment or seconds, when you came back or maybe when you woke up, for some people, you can still tap into those five senses, but from a different level, it's like 10, because your sense of smell and taste and sight are on a different plane, in as much as I think for me, I'm not afraid anymore. I'm not afraid of death, and I can feel the soul. One thing that was really great is that the soul just steps out.
I have absolutely no fear of death.
No fear of death.
Yeah. And my brain injury, where my brain injury was, it changed my taste and my smell. I hated food. When I woke up, I lost 80 pounds because my taste buds changed and my smell changed. I would say in the hospital, this stuff tastes like dog crap, except I didn't say crap. I stopped eating the foods that I liked, like French fries, stuff that was bad for me. I stopped eating that stuff and chips because it tasted like oil. That's all I could taste. So Jody will tell you that I just didn't eat that stuff anymore. Yes.
I don't know if you went out of your body.
I don't know how to say that because I don't know the best way to answer that. I felt like that I was seeing things in my room that were happening around me.
I know you haven't said that, but did you have any connection with your loved ones?
That
you
yeah, I did say that. Absolutely. My sister and my children.
The ones that had passed.
No, I didn't have any connection with any of my relatives that had died. No, there was my connections were with those who were living.
Oh, I see. That was my question.
Yeah. Hi, Emily.
Hey, Greg, could you do us the pleasure of giving us maybe like a 30-second pitch or so of your book?
I would love to give you a 30-second pitch of my book. Ride On, Adventures of a Traumatic Brain Injury. It describes Greg Nordfeldt's adventures as a very driven man who loved adventures, but also had no fear of jumping off of things, diving into things, and writing things. He wasn't afraid, but he was also sometimes a bit stupid. He loved that sense of adventure, and one of those senses of adventure got him into trouble. And he landed himself in a coma and a near-death experience. And if you would like to read more about this, pre-order his book. And it happens to have a form there on your lap. If you'd fill it out and hand it to his wife at the door when you leave, she'd be happy to take the form from you. And there just happens to be a surprise for you if you give her that form tonight. Thank you for asking, Emily. Yes.
So if I understand correctly, when you were in your coma, you didn't really see anything. You noted that you felt bliss, etc., so you were apparently conscious to some degree. Is that right? Do you recall being conscious in another realm, even though you didn't see anything special? Or
everything that I saw was special, and I was conscious the whole time I was in my safe place.
Okay, so you're conscious, but you didn't see
anything.
But
the word conscious seems kind of weird when you're in a near-death experience, isn't it?
Right, that's true.
Yeah, I was unconscious, but I was there in my safe place, and I think I'd use a different word than conscious. I was
aware
that I was in a safe place, and I had no sense of time. I had no pain.
Did you see light or tunnels or anything
like
that?
I did not see a tunnel of light, but I saw plenty of light around me.
Oh, okay.
And it was amazing. It was the same type of light that we're seeing right now. I was in the room,
right,
or I was at the site of the crash, or I was wherever I was. It was earthbound.
Right.
I was seeing wherever I was is where I was.
I was there. I was an earthbound near-death experience, I guess is the best way to describe it.
You've noted your personality changed.
Here's what I learned.
Okay.
All of our differences are meaningless. How we choose to live this life is dependent on our interactions with each other despite our differences. And it's up to us to choose to focus more on this lifetime and choose to connect with each other despite our differences and live blissful, happy lives and make human impact a priority. That's what I learned.
Yeah, no, that's great. And that's very much like we hear many people experience who went to the other side and saw things and were given
Isn't
messages, etc. So obviously,
pretty cool, huh?
Some way got into your mind and brain. And
magically.
Did you experience aphasia yourself? Did you have difficulty
speaking?
Yeah,
I had expressive aphasia. Yeah, I had trouble very early on. I would say loan presentation, loan presentation, loan presentation. And I thought I was saying, Jeremy, how's your first semester at the University of Utah? But what was coming out of my mouth, and I didn't know it, was, Jeremy, how's your loan presentation? And what's going on with your loan presentation tomorrow? And I didn't know it. And then after a few weeks, I would just have problems coming up with sentences altogether. I had severe speaking problems.
Well, it's on the broken side of your brain. Where
and I had severe reading problems. When Laura took me home on a half-day pass, she handed me the Salt Lake Tribune out on the deck, which was my physical safe place, and handed me the Tribune. And what I saw was a bunch of jumbled-up letters, and I couldn't read. So I knew I couldn't read. I had issues. I really took it seriously, what I learned in neuro rehab, and I got my job back.
So I'm not quite sure how to ask this question.
Ask it anyway.
Yeah. You were injured, and then even though you didn't really have a concept of time, how did you spend your time? You just were somehow connected with whoever came in the room, or what about when no one was in the room?
I have absolutely no idea how I spent my time.
Okay.
Honestly.
Okay. Well,
whoever was in the room, I was connected with them, and that was the only thing that was important to me. One of my family members was there, and I had internal connections with them, and it meant everything to me. Mm-hmm. And when they were gone, I don't know what I did.
Maybe because you didn't have that concept of time, maybe you were okay with just being there.
I don't remember.
Okay.
That's a great question.
You mentioned your safe space several times, and you made one comment that kind of stuck with me, how you wished you could go back there, but that's not reality. Do you ever go back to that, as you called it, safe space when you're dreaming in your sleep, or have you ever tried to get back there through meditation or self-hypnosis? And to follow up with that, do you think it might be potentially dangerous, either on a personal or social level, to crave to go back there so severely that one might want to stay in such a safe space?
Thanks for asking that. I don't remember my dreams, so I've never dreamt of it, unfortunately. That'd be really cool. It would be dangerous to really want to go back there, to be honest with you. And there have been times that the world has been harsh on me in the last 6 years. It wouldn't be good. I wouldn't wish it on anybody. I would say that this life is a good place to be. And I really feel good about being in this life.
You had mentioned about how you went through a period where you had hated God because he had taken people from you.
Yes.
And I had lost my 17-year-old son from, he died from lymphoma 4 years ago this month.
I'm so sorry.
And so I am kind of in that same place and about you questioning your church's background beliefs and different things like that. And I'm kind of right where you were then. And so I'm wondering, I know what you just said to the gentleman in the front, which kind of answered that, but could you kind of elaborate a little bit more on that, how you foresee that now versus then? how everything's changed, your reception on that?
Yeah, I would say I wasn't in a good place then. I was in a bad place then.
How it's changed now.
Yes.
From
now.
How it was then, how you see things now differently,
I see everything differently now.
Yeah, but how, I mean.
I would say to you, directly to you, first of all, I'm so sorry for what has happened to you. Secondly, I love you dearly. From me to you is direct love and warmth and graciousness and blissfulness from me to you. And direct connection from one human being to another, impactfulness from me to you. And that's what this life is about. I mean, for us to be here in this world and in this life, if we don't feel that from one another, we're missing the point entirely. And what I learned from being in my coma is I was missing it. I was missing our opportunity, my opportunity, altogether. And I got a chance to do it a second time in a completely different way. I got a second chance.
I can totally understand what you're saying there. I've been to quite a few of these meetings. So, and I've heard other people say how they view their religious beliefs now versus then. How do you view yours?
Independent of religion, this is much different than that. Aside from religion, aside from beliefs, aside from all of that, I'm speaking from a human being to another human being. Love and warmth from me to you, despite our beliefs. That is my message. And that's my feeling to you, from me.
I was just wondering, on your other two traumatic brain injuries, were they recreation-related at all?
They're always recreation related. I'm an adrenaline junkie. I always do stupid things. Just ask Rick. My best friend, for God's sake. I mean, if we're not doing something stupid, then we're just dumb. There's dumbness all about us. That's how we grew up. We're just jumping off of something stupid or somebody dared us. Our lives are based on a dare. Our life activities were based on us just, they dared us to do it. So we said, all right. Yeah. So the answer to that is yes.
I heard you say that when you were in your coma, you received so many gifts.
Yeah.
Would you expound on that?
I tried to give those to you. The most important to me was internal connections, but not having pain was a big one. Never feeling pain that I remember was huge, especially considering how injured I was. The gifts of waking up with no hate, I mean, how can you say that that wasn't a gift? Good night. And the feeling of peace and blissfulness, that all that, you know, anger being gone and being full of love and being able to share that with others and being able to connect. But there's one thing that I didn't share with you, and this is a big one. Now when I'm with people, I can connect with people sometimes, even in a speaking venue, within seconds, and feel what they're feeling. And if I'm speaking to 10 people or 1,000 people, I can tell if my message is working or not. And I can redirect. And I'm a motivational speaker, and being able to do that quickly is kind of cool. And I can sense if I'm off or not, or if I'm having a conversation one-on-one, it's really important to me to make sure that I'm connected or not, and I didn't have that before. It's a gift that was given to me, and there's so many more. If we had time, we could talk one-on-one about a lot of things, but it was just, so anyway, that's just a few.
Thank you for sharing.
You're welcome. Thank you.